This is Touchstone Talk from the Poetry Society of New Hampshire. I'm David Bannick, the editor of Touchstone, and I'm talking today with Leanne St. Laurent about her book, Unwinter, published with Bee Monk Press. Leanne, it was such a pleasure to read this book. I really needed it in this unending February that we're having. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about the title of the collection, how you chose it, what it means to you.
Sure. Thank you. And thank you most of all for inviting me to talk about this little chapbook. It is my debut and very first. So the title of this chapbook, Unwinter, reflects the continuing cycle of changes across the seasons. And the poems are loosely arranged in a seasonal order, starting in late summer and fall, and then into winter, and coming out on the other side of winter again. But for me, it's not only the changes in our physical environment that undergo these cyclical and seasonal changes. I feel like my emotional life is also in a continual state of flux and change, and I'm strongly influenced by this cycle of wintering, unwintering, wintering, and unwintering.
Yeah, I love that. I noticed in the poem, In Which I Die, Become a Bird Tree, there's a line that says, I open the window and unwinter and listen for things I can hear in the dark. Is unwintering like a process of, you know, reawakening in this cycle of seasons?
Maybe it might be a process of just being more attentive to certain things, especially outdoors in the natural world, which is a very, very important piece of my life for me. A lot of these poems you'll see do reflect the natural world. And I'm very tied to the seasons, not just spring, summer, fall, and winter, but all of those little in-between changes within a month. Like it's strawberry time, or it's blackberry time, or it's apple time, or look at that moss, or just look at these little things, or look at the sprouts.
Yeah, I really love that. And I think one of the things that I enjoyed most about these poems is the way in which, you know, even when it's a poem, a love poem, or a poem about your mother, it comes back to little details of the natural world and how our attention to them produces these ecstatic states that allow us to somehow make sense of our lives. Does the slash in Unwinter have a special significance?
It does and it doesn't. a lot of people do ask me about slashes, and I do use slashes in some of my poems. But for me, maybe just visually, it breaks it apart. So it's not just unwinter alone by itself. It's unwinter and winter together.
Ah, yeah, I see that. That's wonderful. Two of your poems were published in the latest issue of Touchstone, in issue 66. I'd love to talk to you about those. The first one we'll talk about is Dustanding, you know, if I said that correctly. And first of all, we'll listen to Leanne reading that poem, and then we'll talk about it a little bit.
Dustanding, you know? Sweetheart, let's do some Swedish death cleaning. Let's do it tonight. We'll put on some real jazz while Sirius swings across the vernal sky. I mean, aren't you a little tired of this surplusage of stuff, this filled house? Fling open the windows and doors. Let's polish off that cheap red blend and dance like we never did before. My God, how the stars sparkle when the moon is new. And oh, didn't I?
So I'd love to hear about how you chose the title for this poem. It's a wonderful title. I appreciated and admired your skill at titling your poems, but I'd love to hear about this one.
Thank you. So, Dustedning is the word in Swedish for the concept of death cleaning. And it's something that people in Sweden embrace, is that when you reach a certain age, like 55, 60 or so, you start minimizing your belongings so that when you pass on, your children aren't burdened with having to get rid of all of your stuff. And I like to try to minimize things in my own life. And there was always a little bit of a conflict with my mom, who I wouldn't say was a hoarder, but I would say she was an accumulator, in that she had a lot of my old toys, and I'm 68, I will openly say that. She had a lot of my old toys in her living room closet, so they were pretty old things. And especially when my mom passed, we actually started, even though the house was a mess and there was a lot of clutter, my sister and I had quite a lot of fun going through all of her things. And unlike a lot of people who just get a huge dumpster and just dump everything and clear out a house, we thought that was just very disrespectful of a person's life and all of their things. That, everything that she had, especially like my toys and things from my sister and just things that she, kept across the year, she cherished those things, and we had to respect that. I eventually opened an Etsy shop. And have found great joy in buying and selling vintage items through the process of cleaning out my mom's estate. That's great fun. But back to the poem, this whole thing, Dustedning, this Swedish death cleaning, is that I definitely don't want my kids to have to clean up the way I had to clean up after my own mom. And it's just kind of like a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek poem about, hey, let's just kind of cut things down and, accept that we are at where we are in our life, and just have a little dance, drink a little wine, fling open those windows, and just, have at it with the rest of our lives.
Yeah, I love how it combines sort of the three big themes of the book, mortality and the loss of a mother, and the wonderful, it's a wonderful love poem, and the details of the natural world. I love how it begins, it starts with Sirius's swing and then the sparkle of the stars and the moon at the end. Another thing I really admired about this poem is the form, and then you have the little introduction, sweetheart, and then I mean, and my God, with a colon, and then each stanza follows. How do you approach form? I really love this one.
Oh, gee. This might sound a little simplistic, but for me, a poem's initial form often arises from a gut feeling. That said, once a poem's on paper, I do like to take a closer look at the strength of the words on the end lines, especially since most of my lines are enjambed. On top of that, I also like to vary line length within a poem sometimes. Sometimes some lines are short and snappy, while others are longer and take the reader on a bit of a ramble. I sometimes there are couplets, sometimes there are lines that are all right aligned, and then they kind of go squiggly and are indented this way or that way. It really is, it sounds silly. It's just a gut feeling, really.
Yeah, I enjoyed very much in this collection sort of the innovative approach to form. I think the second poem we'll talk about is the opening poem of this collection called Ode to the Imperfect Moon, and we'll listen to Leanne reading that poem right now.
Ode to the Imperfect Moon. O moon, my east begins with you. In your easy light, I stand beside the long shadows of my life. I want to swallow the world, but know it won't go down. Instead, I turn these stones and rotted logs in search of crickets. Surely, I can swallow crickets, swallow them whole. And when I walk, my feet will sing.
So, Leanne, why did you start with this poem?
This poem really captures what it's all about for me. It started with just a phrase of "My East begins with you." It just captured me, and I love the moon. I just love going out in the yard and looking at the moon. But thinking about this poem and what it kind of means is, you know, when you're younger, you just want everything. You want to have it all. You want to have the whole world. You want to do everything. But as you age and become more mature, you start to slow down a little bit and just look at things more carefully and become more appreciative of all those small and little moments in life. So, as opposed to the whole world, crickets are just these tiny little things, but they're wonderful little creatures that have a beautiful song if you go out on a summer night and listen to the crickets. And I felt that, well, I can't swallow and I can't eat the whole world. It's just too big. I'll never do it. But that's okay. Not a problem, because these little tiny small crickets, I can swallow them. And when I swallow them, their song will become part of me, myself. And that's where that ending comes, is when I swallow the crickets, my feet will sing, just like the crickets' feet sing.
Oh, that's wonderful. I admire the way in which there's sort of a hopeful real resolution to keep living in all these poems. I really enjoyed
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
And this, you know, you have I think all these poems have a real gift for sound and for you know, lyric singing. I appreciated, you know, the repeated W sounds. I want to swallow the world, but no, it won't go down. And then the I can swallow, crickets swallow them whole. It was like the playing of the crickets. Do you have an approach to rhythm and sound, or do you just let your voice sing naturally?
So I don't follow any specific metric or syllabic patterns. I'm especially not a fan of end rhyme, but I do love to sink into the sounds of a poem. And again, this is a little gutty for me. So when you think about it, there's so many other kinds of rhyme that contribute to a poem's euphonic qualities, like assonance, consonance, alliteration, internal rhyme, even thinking about word choice, like the difference between rock and stone. They both name the same object, but the words have a very different feel and sound about them. So I like to think about how a poem sounds when it's read aloud. And vowels, to me, I especially love assonance in poems. Vowels can be like musical notes, and their high or low frequency can influence the tone or mood of a poem. So if you think about the energy, like in a high frequency long E, or the slower, more ambling sound of a long O or an oo, it really does influence the mood of what you're hearing.
But I could feel the attention to those sounds in these poems. Our next poem is a great example of that as well. It's Self-Portrait as Your Worry Stone, and we're going to listen to Leanne read that right now.
Self-portrait as your worry stone. I taste of salt, salt of the ocean and salt of your palm. You move your thumb back and forth across my back, I carry the worry of water that rolled me back and forth against flanks of sand and a bed of stones so that I may carry yours. I know your blistered soul. I see where you go when you turn out your light. I know your keys, your leather wallet, loose coins, the many man-things on your nightstand. I am volcanic, your flare, your flash. When you wake, you summon my heat, and spring creeps closer. Daphne blooms. A Phoebe sings her name. The shadow of a wasp outside your window treads across the sunlit blinds, builds its paper house.
So I love the form of this poem as well, Leanne. This is more like a prose poem with a little bit of breaks with the slashes. How did you come upon the form for this poem and its relationship to its subject matter?
This one was, again, just that gut feeling. And I don't really write that many prose type of poems, but... I have a new one that I just did recently that almost kind of takes the same form as Self-Portrait as Your Worry Stone. And it's just that ramble of it where it just starts and flows, and it just didn't feel like line breaks were appropriate here. I felt like it just would have interrupted the flow of how this unfolds, and the listing of items, the listing of the things that are observed, and the listing of the things that begin to appear in spring. It just rambled together. And that's why I didn't do any real line breaks here, and just kind of kept it prosy.
I love that, and the breaking up of the lines with the slashes, you know, with the back and forth and back and forth across my back, and that, you know, those repetitions, they feel like, you know, the rubbing of a worry stone.
I did intend that.
I thought so. It's just absolutely gorgeous. This is another one that has an interesting title. Self-Portrait as a Worry Stone is just a great title. Does the title come first, and then, or do you have the poem in hand and then you make a title for it?
This one came title first, and it just, to me, was an interesting concept of how do you portray yourself as someone's worry stone, and the rest just kind of flowed from there with all of the listing of things in the poem.
I find it to be a beautiful love poem. You have a number of beautiful love poems in this book, but it illustrates sort of the type of love that comes from repetition, from knowing a person well, and then it moves to this, you know, to the ecstatic. Do you have an approach to love poems? Do you write them often?
No, and it's funny. I actually have a poem in the book that I titled Love Poem Number One, because for me, I thought that was pretty much the only love poem I've ever written. So it's really interesting for you to say that you view a lot of these poems of mine as love poems.
So, yeah, Just Ending sounds like a love poem to me, and this is just a beautiful, tender poem.
Thank you.
So I want to talk about the ending of this poem as well. This is one of these, I think you do this so well in so many of your poems, is we're talking about a relationship, and then all of a sudden we're zooming out to these details of nature, just gorgeous. You know, the Daphne blooms, the Phoebe sings, and the sounds are gorgeous as well. How did you hit upon those details? How did they flash into your mind? And especially the wasp and the paper house. That's just a great ending. I admire your endings as well. You know, they don't uh, they they're appropriate and they hit us hard, but they don't sort of tie up the poem in a nice neat bow. We're left to really think and contemplate that image.
Yeah, this is actually a very literal ending. I was sitting at my desk, and there was a wasp walking across the sunlit blinds, and that just struck me as a part of spring that is a little bit ominous, almost like the shadow of the wasp treading across the blinds after all of the beautiful things like the phoebe, the bird singing right outside my window. There are phoebes that sit on the electrical wire leading from the street to the house, and they just sit there and call their name. And that's why they're called the phoebe. They just sit there and say, Phoebe, Phoebe. And the daphne was blooming. These are just, it's just everything was very, very literal. And this is one of those poems that just welled up and was pretty much written as is in a moment. Many poems I labor over and labor over an ending or fret about this or move lines around and fuss with the words at the end of a line. But this one really just welled up and it was all unfolded right in front of my eyes.
Yeah, we can feel that. There's so many ecstatic moments, and they're contrasted. You know, this poem is, this book is about, in some ways, a mature person who's experienced life and is still able to reawaken themselves to its beauty and to its moments. So I appreciate the way in which you're able to elicit those little instants of ecstasy that you get from paying attention to the details of the natural world. So the next poem that we'll talk about is Unbeliever, What is Your North Star? And we'll listen to Leanne read that right now.
Unbeliever, what is your North Star? I calibrate the ticking of my pulse to the chime of the earth ringing like a bell on winter nights. You believe in holy, but I believe in haloed moons that foretell a glaze of new snow. Oh, the unbearable beauty of it all. The surprise of a hexagon is enough to bring me to my knees. My own mother ebbs, confides that when she goes to sleep, she wonders if she will wake in the morning. I know I can't keep her pressed between the pages of this book like one of spring's first violets. And I, now an eggless woman, consider each sequential folding and unfolding of that moon, set my breath to its sensible division of time, and pray, Ichigo, Ichiya.
So, Leanne, this poem as well seems to deal with time and little eternal moments of beauty. Do you want to talk about the title and the theme of this poem?
Sure. For me, I'm a very nature-bound person. I'm not very religious. I think a lot about my own mortality and what's to come or not to come at some point in my life. But I like to feel how I like to think about how I am bound to this natural world. And I was walking my mom through her final years, and I was thinking a lot about her and her aging, and then as her daughter, you know, becoming her and my own aging. And it just seemed to me, I just loved that thought of the moon and how the moon has this haze around it on a winter night, mm-hmm. and just the beauty of the snow in the winter. And just thinking about the ending of that poem, the last two words are Japanese, and that's what the epigraph, I added, I didn't add the epigraph until just a very recent, until very recently when the book was published. This poem was did appear in a journal, Emerge Literary Journal, about 2 or so years ago, and I didn't have the epigraph, but I did have those two words. Ichigo Ichie is a Japanese concept of right here, right now, one time, one place. And again, it's that concept of being in the moment and capturing being in that moment. And it doesn't matter how long you're going to, how much longer you're going to live, or whether or not you're going to be here tomorrow, a week from now, we just don't know. So we really do have to grasp that moment and enjoy the beauty of it right then and there. That's pretty much what it wraps up in the epigraph. Once in a Lifetime is from that title song, The Talking Heads. I thought that would just be kind of neat to throw that in there because I love The Talking Heads and I just love that song. And this is literally translated, Ichigo Ichie, is Once in a Lifetime.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. And I love the contrast of that, you know, the one eternal moment of perceiving this beauty and being in the moment with the recognition of the, you know, the ebb and flow of a mother feeling themselves aging, and then the, you know, the recognition of a woman in menopause, recognizing and feeling the spread and the flow of time, and yet still grasping at these moments that somehow escape time.
I love that phrase, like, of being like, I thought, how could I, like, how do you poetically say, hey, I'm a menopausal woman? And I thought, and now I, an eggless woman.
I like that too. I like it very much. And I this is another poem where I appreciate the form. It's like kind of a prose poem without stanzas, but I loved that it was sort of a sandwich. You start with the ticking of the pulse, and then it ends with the setting of the breath to the vision, and the sequential folding and unfolding of the moon is just a gorgeous image. So you can tell that you had some attention to the, you know, to the form that mimicked the passage of time and then the eternal moments. So I really appreciated this poem. Yeah, and this poem is one that I think leads to the theme. You know, there's many themes in this poem, though. I think the overarching one is just attention to the ecstatic moments of beauty that you can find in nature and how they in some way redeem our life. But I mentioned that I saw lots of love poems in some of these, and I also felt, just like the epigram of this collection that mentioned, you know, your mother, the ending poems like Gift and If a Mother's Falls, and then the untitled poem on the last page, seemed to suggest that there was a theme of grief going on in this poem as well. Did you want to talk about that, or how it felt in, or it folded itself into the flow of this book?
Are we talking about The Unbeliever or the one at the end of the book, David?
The Unbeliever mentions the mother's ebb and flow, but I noticed that three of the last poems, the ending poems of the book, Gift, If a Mother Falls, and then the untitled last poem, also seem to be about grief for the mother. So that's what I was talking about.
Yes. There is a lot of grief here in a lot of these poems, and I was very, very close to my mother, and I feel very lucky that for a person my age, that I had her in my life for such a long time. She was 98 when she passed away, so that really is a very long time. And just that loss is so tremendous. I just miss her every day. And it's funny because when I was putting this together as a chapbook, Mike Nelson, the publisher at Bead Monk Press, asked me if I had a dedication, and I would like to read that dedication.
Please do. Please do.
I said, "This little book is dedicated to the most mischievous ghost I know, my mother. She is everywhere at all times." And I really do think that she is everywhere at all times. In so many of the things that I do, I see her. I literally think of her being everywhere, especially since she was cremated. I picture her going up the chimney and spreading herself all around town, literally. So there is a lot of grief here, but especially in that poem, If a Mother Falls, it takes a little bit of a comic twist at the end, where the pines are whispering. And if you don't mind, I'll just read that last line. Or is it the pines outside her window? They brush soft arms against the morning sky and whisper. But where was she going without her teeth? And that really is the way we found her, literally. And funny thing about this poem, it's one of the first poems that I wrote after a fairly long dry spell of several months when I just couldn't even write about the grief that I was feeling over the loss of my mother. And this poem just kind of welled up one day, especially thinking about, you know, her home, which is the childhood home that I grew up in. And I just thought of that, that concept of, hey, if a tree falls in a forest, does anybody hear it? And I thought, hey, if a mother falls and she's all by herself in the house, you know, who hears it when she hits the floor? And that's kind of what that poem was all about. There's a lot of grief here, but I tried to wrestle that grief and come to terms with it and kind of maybe even find some funny little moments in there as well and move along. But as I move along, also recognize that I do keep my mother everywhere with me at all times.
Yeah, and that last, you know, the last poem, If a Mother Falls, of course, you know, the saying of the poem and the writing of the poem, you know, puts us in it, and we're attending to it. One of the themes of this collection, I think, is the way our attention to nature, our attention even to grief in some way transforms it and transforms us. One of my favorite quotes about poetry is from Ada Lyman, who says, "The more I put grief in a poem, the more I'm able to move freely through the world because I've named it and spoken it and thrown it out into the sky." So I felt, you know, this collection to be very freeing. And I'm sure there are plenty of readers out there who will find this collection of poems not only a way of making sense of the grief that afflicts every human life, but also of finding the type of ecstasy and redemption in our attention to the natural world. If you don't mind, Leanne, I'd love to end by having you read the last untitled poem that had to do with your mother from the very ending of this book.
Sure. And you mentioned something very important, and it's what other readers take away from a book when they're reading it. And I'd like to say that I feel like I am and am not my mother. And just like wintering and unwintering, the parent-child relationship is also very cyclical. And I did think about my own aging as I walked my mom through her final years and into her death and beyond. But in the end, it's really quite simple that this book is about me fretting about my own mortality. And I'm sure that these are things that everyone worries about eventually. Mm-hmm. But in the end, what I hope is that my words are universal enough for readers to relate to, and that I do leave room for them to discover their own meaning in my poems, including any meaning in their life about their own grief or their own joy. So here is the last, and this is an untitled piece. There are a couple of just untitled smatterings of poems throughout this book. But for me, this is just, again, that cycle of growth and growing and living and what we become. How do I name the body from which my own body sprang? Hyacinth, tulip, mother, ashes.
Oh, thank you. We've been talking with Leanne St. Laurent about her book, Unwinter, published on Bee Monk Press. Thank you, Leanne.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure, and this book was a pleasure as well. You've been listening to an episode of Touchstone Talk from the Poetry Society of New Hampshire. You can hear other episodes and the audio editions of our latest issue of Touchstone, and hear more about poetry events in New Hampshire at psnh.org.